The following program is recorded content created by the Truth Network.
Wake up, everyone. It's time for the Steve Noble Show, where biblical Christianity meets the everyday issues of life in your home, at work, and even in politics. Steve is an ordinary man who believes in an extraordinary God, and on his show, there's plenty of grace and lots of truth, but no sacred cows. Call Steve now at 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Or check him out online at thestevenobleshow.com. And now, here's your host, Steve Noble.
You are in the midst of a culture war, whether you want to believe that or not. It is happening. It's been happening for a while. It's nothing new. It's not just contained to the United States of America. There's been a culture war between God's people and the rest of Earth's people ever since there was God's people. And so we can go into the scriptures and see examples of this and try to learn from it. So last week, I believe, it was Austin Gentry's been on the show before. It's been a few years. He had a great book that came out about three years ago, came out in 2018, called 10 Things Every Christian Should Know for College, A Student's Guide on Doubt, Community, and Identity. A great resource, especially if you have children or grandchildren that are, you know, juniors, seniors in high school, moving towards college or just started college or are in college already. It's really a great resource, so I would encourage you. You can get that on Amazon. I put some links up on Facebook Live today. But Austin sent me recently through Facebook a link to his blog site, just Austin Gentry, GENTRY.com. And the title of the entry was Tactics of Cultural Warfare, which he assumed rightly that I would be interested in that. And a really fascinating look here on Theology Thursday at Daniel chapter 1 showing us, and this is from Austin's article, shows us is that Babylon's tactics of cultural warfare, we're talking nearly 3,000 years ago against Judah, are eerily similar to the tactics being used in the culture wars happening today, right here in our backyard. So there's a lot to learn from this particular passage of scripture, and it's great to have Austin back on the show with us today to guide us through that. Austin, how you doing, my friend? Good to have you back.
I'm doing great. Great to be on.
I really appreciate you sending me a link for this before we dive into it because I want to unpack this. How are you doing? I mean, I sent this note to you because I was, I still don't think I figured out who texted me, but somebody texted me because you had, and everybody, just so you know, Austin's a young millennial, healthy individual, and had a really nasty bout with COVID. So how are you feeling?
First of all, thanks for the prayers. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better. It just got me down for about 3 weeks there. I actually had to go to the hospital for several days just to kind of revive kind of my system a little bit. But it was a weird experience. You know, I think that we all know that, you know, the virus has just affected different people in different ways. My 87-year-old grandfather got it, and he was tired for 2 days and lost his smell, and that was it. And yet, you know, I work out almost 5 times a week, and I'm a millennial, and I'm generally healthy, and it just, you know, knocked me sideways. So, but it's great to be back. Health is something that we cannot take for granted, and
Amen.
So I'm just thankful for the Lord to bring me back to full strength almost, and I'm just getting better each day. So,
yeah, praise the Lord. That's great. You're welcome. And just so you know, for most of you in North Carolina, Austin's North Carolina-based, essentially. Went to UNC Chapel Hill, also went to Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, where he got his Master's of Divinity, and now he's down. Yeah, you're actually back in the state of my birth down there, Austin. He's at the Young Adults Pastor for Second Baptist Church in Houston, Texas. So fantastic article. Great job. Really well-researched and well-written out. But what kind of got this going for you, Austin? Why did you decide to look into the book of Daniel in the first place? And then we'll dive into how this applies to us.
Yeah, great question. So for the past 2 years now, just in my personal quiet time devotionals, what I've been doing is just studying one book of the Bible a month. 6 in the Old Testament, 6 in the New Testament. And so every other month, I'm switching between the new and the old, reading and studying a new book. And so last year, I studied the book of Daniel in depth, really for the first time. You know, when you hear of the book of Daniel, you think, oh, you know, the lion's den and like the furnace and, you know, some other stuff that seems kind of cool. And so I started really digging into the context, the culture, the stories. And in doing that, I also like to follow my personal quiet time devotions with a sermon series as well that I can just listen to in the car. And I actually was, I tuned into a pastor named Kyle Mercer, who's the pastor of a church in Winston-Salem called
yeah.
Twin Cities Church.
Yep.
And he has a fantastic sermon series on the book of Daniel.
I actually know him, Austin. I know him.
Oh, cool.
He was the college pastor at my son's church when my son was going to school down in Orlando, which is where he came from.
No way. That's really interesting.
Small world.
Yeah, we've since connected a little bit because one of the young adults from Second Baptist moved to Winston and is getting connected at Two Cities. And anyway, I started listening to his sermon series. It's fantastic. He does a really great job diving into just all the nuance of the book of Daniel. And listening to his sermon series actually inspired me to write this post because there was, in one or two of his messages, he kind of did a flyby of some of these tactics of cultural warfare. And when he first said it, I was just like, wow, that was a big bomb that was just dropped. And I want to like dig into this further.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He was truly the inspiration behind why I wrote the post. And a couple of the points from the post were kind of derived from his series. And so I actually sent it on to him last week as well as a thank you for kind of the inspiration behind it.
Cool. That's great. Yeah, because when you get into it and the way we approach this, and we'll unpack this with Austin throughout the rest of the show, is you look and this was the cultural warfare that Babylon, the Babylonian Empire, was employing against Judah, against the people of God. So you look at, it's kind of reverse engineering. We tend to think of what are we doing to win the culture war? Well, what's the other side doing? Sun Tzu said once that, you know, you kind of keep your enemies, friends close and your enemies closer, and you really got to study your enemies. That's what, this was so eye-opening when you sent it to me. I was hooked immediately and read right through it. And we're going to unpack this, basically those 4 points, kind of 4 main tactics of cultural warfare we can see in Daniel 1. And again, as I read these to you guys, and then Austin will lead us through them to understand them as we unpack the show. These are what's being employed against us as people of God, people of the book, and these should kind of sound familiar. So let me just read through these right quick, Austin, and then we'll unpack them as we get into the show.
Sure.
Number 1, assimilate the best and ostracize the rest. We'll get through that. Number 2, this should definitely ring true, emasculate men. We see that all over the place. Number 3, how about this one? We've been talking about education a lot on the show lately. Austin, indoctrinate through the government school system. They were doing it then, and that's also happening now. And then number 4, this is also fascinating. One of the reasons, Austin, that I've decided this fall, you know, I've been teaching high school age homeschoolers for years, adding this fall, a 2-semester class on U.S. history. Point number 4, rename people, places, and things of the old culture in the language of the new culture so that the old culture's history and values are lost. Those all are exactly what we see going on. Very prescient. Great job, Austin. We're talking to Austin Gentry about this article, Tactics of Cultural Warfare, that you can find on his blog post, austingentry.com. And we're going to pick it up there on Theology Thursday. Austin, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll be right back.
There's a man going around taking names.
Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show. Tactics of Cultural Warfare today on Theology Thursday. Austin Gentry, who is a North Carolina-based millennial, really. Now he's down in Texas serving at the Second Baptist Church in Houston, Texas, as the young adults pastor. Wrote an incredible article that he shared with me recently on his blog page, and you can get his book there and other resources at austingentry.com, G-E-N-T-R-Y, Tactics of Cultural Warfare, looking at Daniel 1. And it really is amazing, Austin, again, thanks for being with us, how so much of this just jumps right off the pages of Scripture, right into the current context. Was that your experience as you kind of started to unpack this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we you know, as Christians believe that God's Word is timeless, right? So that means it's always timely. We're going to see things, you know, 2,000 years ago that were written that look eerily similar to things that we see today.
Yeah, it's really, so I'd love to go through this point by point. I'll just kind of set up each point, and then you kind of walk us through it. I highlighted the tar out of this, so I've got more yellow than I do white on this printed out version of your blog. It's really excellent. But let's start with this first one. Assimilate the best, ostracize the rest. So here we are looking in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Then the king commanded Aphanez, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge. So the best of the best, assimilate the best, ostracize the rest. How do we see that happening here in America today?
Yeah, well, whenever a dominant culture wants to replace a subculture or to impose itself on a subculture, one of the tactics that you see happening just in our day-to-day lives, and it's not new. This has been happening for thousands of years, and we see it in Babylon with Judah, is that the dominant culture, where it has a harder time extending itself into these other subcultures, what they will do oftentimes is find gatekeepers and stakeholders and people who, like Daniel and his friends, are intelligent and they're sharp and they have connections and resources and wealth. And they find those gatekeepers that, in a way, lead these subcultures, and they try to pretty much wine and dine them. They try to recruit them in a way, because if power can't squelch other power, what it'll do in response is they'll try to cater to it because it finds exploitative value in it. So they see these stakeholders, they see these gatekeepers, and they try to wine and dine them as, you know, their A-list recruits, if you will, because if they can convert them,
yeah,
then maybe the dominant culture is not all that bad after all. Maybe look what they did for us. Certainly for our subculture, they're going to be for us. They're going to win for us too, right? Well, you know, oftentimes those are promises that they don't keep or checks they don't cash exactly. That's another story. But, you know, what they do is they try to convert these gatekeepers and stakeholders because, in a way, they represent the future of that subculture.
Exactly.
In a way, they are the leadership that will move that subculture forward. And so what it wants to do, in a way, is that the dominant culture will want to assimilate the best, so to speak, the gatekeepers, stakeholders, and really ostracize the rest of the people because, after all, they don't really need them. They don't really offer anything to the dominant culture. And, you know, we see that happening, you know, in our own political landscape. Some people are valued as more strategic than others. And, I mean, think about, for example, a certain presidential candidate joining forces with a pop culture icon.
Right.
Someone that he might not otherwise have real influence in. But as soon as you kind of combine those two forces, well, now we have access to a new subculture that we weren't going to find. Or, for example, when a social movement might find additional momentum on the coattails of a professional athlete or a movie star who really has no clue what this social movement is all about.
Yeah.
You know, or another example, like you just find a particular outlier who has a platform and they do not represent the subculture at all, but they have their own convictions that might align with the dominant culture. Well, you know, they're going to try to exploit that and then paint a picture broadly as a result. So this is ways that the culture war works. You look for the best, quote unquote, the gatekeepers, the stakeholders, those who have influence. Then you really ostracize the rest because there's no value.
Well, we certainly see. I mean, you saw this happen. You know, you could look at from the right's perspective. You can look at Donald Trump and who was it? Who ran?
Like
ended
Lil
up,
Wayne.
Lil Wayne, and then there was someone who else ended up running for president, is divorcing Kim Kardashian.
Kanye West. Yeah.
Kanye West. Okay, something like that. Then BLM and everybody that's associated with BLM. But then you also see it, Austin, and you've been around young people, obviously, where you see a lot of kids that grew up in church, grew up in evangelical churches, and then they're like insiders. They're a part of that subculture, but then they kind of get co-opted and wooed away by people that are also their age who don't believe the same thing, social media influencers. I mean, to a certain extent, with like Rhett and Link, who grew up in Crew. I mean, they were in the middle of evangelicalism, and then, what, a year or so ago, they did their deconstructing their faith. And that really messed a lot of people up, and it's going to pull some young people over. And so you assimilate them or you ostracize. And that really, I think, is the whole cancel culture right now. Either you're going to play by our game or we're just going to ostracize you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, too. You know, I heard this from some pastor. I'm not going to take credit for this, but they were saying that, like, especially with the younger generations, they're looking at their phones, you know, 18 hours a day. And the people that speak most into their life, the people who are quote unquote discipling them, are these media stars that they have no relationship with. And
that's,
you know, if the media star says it and they're a big deal, then
clearly
they know what they're talking about. And oftentimes that just isn't the case. You know, my roommates and I, we like to watch the NBA a good bit. And one thing that was frustrating for us was, you know, especially during a lot of the political turmoil, was that after these games, the interviewers on ESPN or TNT, they would ask them, "Hey, what are your thoughts on this social situation?" And
right.
We're like, "That's the last person that we should hear it from, because who knows how much, like, how credible they are as
right, exactly.
Of the official event, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like, well, why are we giving them a microphone?
Exactly.
You know, it doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah, well, Dora on Facebook Live brought that up to Colin Kaepernick. You know, Colin Kaepernick is somebody that you wouldn't normally look to for social commentary or political commentary, and he creates this whole movement, and people go along with it. They're kind of co-opted in, and if you don't go along with it, well, you're a racist or whatever, and so we're just going to ostracize you. We're going to cancel you. The next point, we're going to hit a break here in about a minute. Emasculating men. Okay. We see this going on all over the place. I'm just going to set this one up. I'm just reading from Austin's blog here, okay, at austingentry.com. It was an ancient tradition that servants in the king's court would be made into eunuchs. While Daniel 1 does not explicitly indicate that Daniel and his friends were made into eunuchs, the book of Isaiah suggests so. Emasculating male leadership meant more than just sexual restraint. It meant death to their culture. We see this going on all over the place. We're now, like you mentioned this in the article, what's a word that we associate with masculinity now? Toxic. So it's pretty amazing when you look at this, and I want to unpack this because this is really powerful. The culture war is aiming to functionally emasculate them, meaning men, by three powerful methods. Listen and see if this doesn't ring true to all you guys. Porn, abortion, and the deconstruction of gender as a whole. So let's start the porn thing. Just a couple of opening comments on that when we come back. So we'll unpack that. How is this culture war against us, against believers, against people of the book, using porn, abortion, and gender to emasculate men? Because if you do that, you're one step closer to controlling the culture, obliterating the subculture. And the subculture, in case you're wondering, by the way, in this case, is us, Christ followers. Austin Gentry, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll be right back. Keep unpacking this very, very important today on Theology Thursday. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, Theology Thursday today. We're diving into the book of Daniel, considering tactics of cultural warfare. These are the tactics that are being used against, in Daniel's case, is being used against Judah, against the people of God. Today, it's largely being used against us in the American context, against the church in general. The author of the article, Austin Gentry, austingentry.com is the website, G-E-N-T-R-Y, tactics of cultural warfare. I can't really do it justice on the radio for an hour or 40 minutes in radio time. So make sure you get it. I would encourage you to read it, share it, print it off, grab a highlighter. This is old school, okay? Grab a highlighter and just work your way through it and highlight things, because Scripture does this, and proper application of Scripture just jumps out and makes itself applicable. As Austin said earlier, it's timeless, which means it's always timely, and you're going to find all kinds of fruit on the tree here as you work through it, which is why we're doing this today. Again, Austin, thanks for taking the time to be with us, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an honor to be on. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So we're talking through the second point, which is about emasculating men. We see this should be pretty obvious to everybody. But you mentioned three things that, and our ultimate enemy is not the culture. It's not a political party. It manifests itself in a lot of different ways. Our ultimate enemy, of course, is Satan himself. But porn, abortion, and the deconstruction of gender as a whole. So help us understand those in the context of this culture war against us.
Yeah, absolutely. So back when Daniel and his three friends were in the courts of Babylon, it was very common for kings in that time to make all the men in the court eunuchs. And of course, like, you know, that's not happening in our day and age, at least in America, thank goodness. But there were many reasons, of course, why they made men eunuchs in the king's court. But most of it is that in the king's court, there were men who were strategic, and they were leaders, and they were people of power. And so in emasculating them, the king was able to maintain as much control as he could. And so, you know, in the same way, you see in the culture war, three main tactics, I believe, that are not making men eunuchs literally, of course, but
right,
are functionally doing that, making men eunuchs functionally. And those three things are porn, abortion, and the deconstruction of gender, really, as a whole. And so, and this is how it kind of works. With porn in general, you know, we live in a culture where it's accessible now more than really ever before. And what it does is it gives the high access to porn, and coupled with the low cost of abortion in our culture especially,
yep,
it essentially, what it does, it encourages men to not be men as God designed them to be. But it encourages men to be takers instead of givers. It encourages us to live on pleasure instead of living on responsibility. And it, in a way, it makes us chained and it weakens us to the things that make us strong as God designed us. Delayed gratification, relational investment, and societal responsibility. Porn, high access to that, and a low cost of abortion, it really means that we don't need to do any of those things.
Yeah.
We don't need to have delayed gratification. We don't need to have relational investment. And we don't need to have societal responsibility. And as the men, you know, who are in a way leading culture in many respects, these are things that are going to inhibit him from actually doing
right.
so. And
right.
and what will replace the man being the leader in the culture? Well, of course, the government and those who are in power formally. They don't want to make the men strong in their society because it keeps them in power. And
right.
what we see
exactly.
that happening is doing that now. So
how can you be an effective watchman on the wall looking out for the people if you're busy watching porn, indulging yourself, and then hiding the results of that kind of a promiscuous lifestyle by having paying for an abortion? And I was saying over the break on Facebook Live, Austin, that every Saturday when I'm down at an abortion clinic out there praying and I see these men come up, and half the women, it's another girlfriend that brings them or whatever, but half the time it's a guy that brings them. He pulls in, she goes inside, and he leaves. I'm out of here. Here's $500. Go get rid of the evidence, whatever. And I leave. Talk about emasculation. And they're just gone. Mm. And now we have the whole issue of gender. You mentioned this, which was kind of sad. In our culture, this culture war declares masculinity is toxic, I'm reading from the blog, while simultaneously saying gender is fluid and non-binary. So this one's really obvious to me. So help us understand this emasculating men by just getting rid of gender.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so basically, if being a man is bad,
right,
well, if that's not a strong enough argument, then what we're going to do is we're just going to deconstruct the very concept of gender as a reality. We're going to say,
right.
well, gender's fluid, anyways. It's not male and female. It's really just a big spectrum, and this is why the trans movement has gained so much momentum as of recently. Is because we can't say that someone's a man and someone's a woman because that could be offensive to someone, and we can't really tell the truth. But if you think about it, if you say that masculinity in and of itself is toxic, and then you also say, well, gender is also fluid and non-binary, that is conceptual chaos, right? Like the intent there exceeds its own logical framework. And so basically, you know, it doesn't want you to really associate male with anything. And if you do associate male or actually believe in it, then, well, it's wrong. And so this is how a power-hungry culture or dominant culture trying to get rid of a subculture seeks to do. It seeks to make the men non-existent in a way. And functionally, you know, through deconstruction philosophy and just through associations with labels, that's what our culture is doing right now with men. We don't really want them to exist in a way, if that makes sense.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Philosophically, yeah.
Yeah, right at the end of that section. Yeah, let me just read this part. Why is emasculating men a tactic of the culture, cultural warfare against us? Okay, everybody? Because what a culture fears the most is strong men who love their families and raise their children up in a way that is contrary to the spirit of Babylon. So if you're a strong, godly man, if you're married and have kids, you are a major enemy. And we can't let you reproduce and have other young, strongly godly men. Porn, abortion, and the deconstruction of gender is a tool that they're using to get rid of that, because we're very, very dangerous. That's why our role is so important, and we have to step up to the plate. Let's jump to this one. I talk about this a lot on the air because we've had critical race theory and a lot of things going on in public education. But indoctrinate through government school system, and they were actually doing that in Daniel's context, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, in verse 4 of chapter 1, it says that Nebuchadnezzar didn't just try to teach them anything. He wanted to teach his Jewish A-list recruits, specifically, I'm reading from the Bible here, it says, to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they would stand before the king. So they were being educated in what kind of philosophy? Well, in the literature and language of the Chaldeans. They were taught a particular worldview. It wasn't just education in general that they were teaching them. They were teaching them a very particular type of education, what they wanted them to believe. And, you know, that's the same kind of thing that's happening, really. And this isn't to say that public schools are wrong, you know, or state universities are wrong. I went to one. I was glad I went to one. I grew so much going to one. But the state system of education will always reflect the ideology of those who are most in power.
Exactly.
That's just what's always going to happen. And that's we see that happening right now in our culture war as well.
Oh, man, across the board. And that's why when we look at D.C. all the time and kind of focus our energy and our efforts and even our prayers, if you pray, for people in elected office, we focus on D.C. But when it comes to education, that's happening locally. And most Christians that say they care about the culture and care about education don't know anything about the local school system. And so you have this problem out there that's happening all over the place. Because to your point, when the Bible says the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, in our public school system, they are not being taught how to think. They're being taught what to think, which is exactly what was going on in Daniel's time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and the reason why the government or those who are most in power want to leverage the educational system is because they see that educational system as the engine, really, for tearing down ideological frameworks of the past that we have to progress from, and really, you know, raising up new ideological frameworks for the new society that they want to usher in that they believe is better. And so, you know, if you can teach your kids that, of course, then that's what how the rest of the society will follow. So power and education go hand in hand. They're not mutually exclusive. There's not a lot of give and take there.
That's exactly right.
I don't think what there is.
No, it's a great point. So the last point here, and then also in the last segment of the show, we're going to talk about, okay, what did Daniel do and what can we do? But this is also a huge one that I talk about pretty regularly on the show. And this fall, I'm going to start teaching U.S. history, but this is so important. Rename people, places, things of the old culture in the language of the new culture so that the old culture's history and values are lost. So we look at our context here in America and I go, why would the culture war against us want to rename, change, destroy our past? Because our past came out of the soil of a Judeo-Christian worldview. So that's exactly what's going on, isn't it?
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And so in the book of Daniel, what happens is the king, Nebuchadnezzar, he renames each of his Jewish A-list recruits because they all had names that reflected the God they worshiped. Yahweh in some kind of form or another. And so what he did was he gave them all new names reflective of the Chaldean pagan worship and the gods that, you know, kind of encompass that worldview. So he's renaming them, re-identifying them in a way that he wants them to now identify as people.
Right.
Which
is really interesting. It's not good to be an Israelite. It's much better to be a Babylonian. In this case today, it's not great to be an American or a patriot. You need to be somebody that sees through that. You need to be a progressive. We're talking to Austin Gentry about this great blog post. We'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Steve Noble, the Steve Noble Show, Theology Thursday today, working our way through a great article, Tactics of Cultural Warfare, looking at the book of Daniel and looking at the massive cultural war that was being waged against the people of God, against Judah. Daniel 1 shows us, I'm reading from the article by Austin Gentry, is that Babylon's tactics of cultural warfare nearly 3,000 years ago against Judah are eerily similar to the tactics being used in the cultural war happening today. I was just referencing, for those of you on Facebook Live and YouTube Live, an article out of USA Today about Oral Roberts. Okay, Oral Roberts University is kind of the Cinderella story of March Madness making it to the Sweet 16. And this author, USA Today, Hamel Javeri, I don't know anything about her. But she's talking about, okay, there's all this stuff. Should people excited? Great, should be excited. But here's what it says. And yet, as the spotlight grows on Oral Roberts and it reaps the goodwill, publicity, and revenue of a national title run, the university's deeply bigoted anti-LGBTQ+ policies can't and shouldn't be ignored. Essentially, the point of her article is, we shouldn't celebrate a school like this. A school like this, with these types of viewpoints, shouldn't even be allowed to compete in something as prestigious as the Sweet 16. A perfect example of what we're talking about today. Austin, I know you're a sports fan. Did you know about that one with Oral Roberts versus USA Today?
I have, yeah. I've been kind of reading up on it, clicking some links here when I see it. But in a way, this shouldn't surprise us because this is just carried through the wake of all these other cancel culture things, especially with the Christian worldview that we see happening. It's just another example now in the NCAA tournament. So, yeah.
Yeah, perfect example. And then we're talking to point number four. Then we're going to talk about what Daniel did, because it's the same thing that we need to be doing. But this last point, so, so powerful. And again, this should be obvious to everybody. Rename people, places, and things of the old culture. Think U.S. history in our case, in our culture. In the language of the new culture, progressivism, so that the old culture's history and values are lost. This, I think the perfect example of this is the 1619 Project. So let's look at what was going on in Jamestown, which was populated by a bunch of scumbags, versus what was going on in Plymouth. There were really two different things going on early in the days of this nation's history. And now we got to repaint it, that this nation was born out of nothing but hatred for black people, slavery, patriarchal system, white supremacy, and greed. And so you just kind of redefine the past, right? So that way you can control the future. You get rid of anything good from the past. Is that essentially what's going on here?
Yeah, definitely. So what you see going on here in the book of Daniel, and we talked about this in the last segment, is that the king of Babylon just renamed them. And they were named in the name of Judaism, names that reflected the worship of their god, Yahweh. And now he's renaming them after the names of his own pagan gods of Babylon, because he wants to essentially make them into a new identity. He doesn't want the oldness of their Judaism to infect the newness that he wants to make them into.
Yeah, and so when you look at, if we kind of look at, this is a matter of renaming when for years in this country, say, well, do we believe in a Judeo-Christian ethic? Yes. Do we think that the Ten Commandments are beneficial to society? Yes. Do we think prayer in school is helpful? Yes. Now all of a sudden you look at that and go, no, it's oppressive, it's patriarchal, it's white supremacy, it's this, that, and the other thing. Is that kind of, am I seeing that correctly, Austin, as we kind of compare Daniel to what we see today? Just literally kind of change definitions, change names, that, like you're saying.
Yeah. We see changing names a good bit in our culture in many ways. And really, there's a science to it, because when you change the names of things, it's not just an arbitrary change the name because it just better reflects things. What they're doing, the psychology of it all, is the words are powerful, and words are essentially the architect of how we see the world. They are architects of meaning. They are associations that we build between ideas and things. And so when you change the words of something, you change the names of something, you're using a power play, because what you're doing is you're dismissing some meanings and you're reinforcing other meanings. And so when you can change words and rename things, you're changing meanings, but what you're doing is you're changing the way that people think. And this is exactly what's happened. In fact, I read a book last year called 1984 by George Orwell.
Yeah,
he pretty much predicted this. Like when a new culture wants to take over an old culture, it's easy enough. We'll just burn the history books and we'll rename things. And if you even dare to think about it or bring it up in a certain perspective, we're going to punish you. And if you enforce celebrate what we do tell you, if you use the right language and not the wrong language, then we'll give you stuff, you know. And so you have this happening in our culture now. It's called hate speech, and you can't say certain things, because if you do, then you're not believing what we want you to believe. There's no tolerance. Imagine that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we see today, right? The tolerance is anything but. This is from your blog as well. This is at austingentry.com, by the way, and I put links up on Facebook Live today. Gentry is spelled G-E-N-T-R-Y, austingentry.com. A power-hungry culture that is seeking to win the war, the culture war, on another subculture, will not tolerate other diversity of viewpoints, diversity of thought, or diversity of language. That's gone. So the party or the group that says they're all about tolerance or anything but. So let's kind of switch to the positive side in terms of what we do, because you talk about what Daniel did and you said that he drew a line. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So in the book of Daniel, in verse 8, chapter 1, it says that Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or drink, or the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him to not defile himself. And so what he did essentially was he drew a line at the king's food. And what's really interesting is they're like, why draw the line there? And,
right.
And why does the king's food make you, quote-unquote, defiled? Because most commentators believe that there was nothing really wrong with the food in terms of its diet. I know the Jewish custom had dietary restrictions. They don't really have any evidence to believe that. And so what's weird is it's like, wait, okay, I think that Daniel has already been defiled, right? I mean, he was made into a eunuch. He was given another education. He was given another name. Like, he was told who to worship. I mean, this seems like he's already been defiled, right? I mean, but what Daniel did was he drew a line in an area that at least he had an opportunity to do. He had at least some free will in this area of his life, in the culture war, where he said, you know what, I can't control how they identify me. I can't control the educational system they threw me in. I can't control the name that they're now calling me by. But, you know, this is an opportunity where I don't have to eat this kind of food. And I'm going to see if there's a way for me to not defile myself in a way from associating with the king. And that's what I believe was going on here. It's not just the food as a dietary reflection of, you know, certain religious principles, but rather that the food was in a way representative of the king trying to associate himself with these new recruits. He's trying to be their provider. He's trying to be their sustainer. He's trying to be their God in a way. And so what he's trying to wine and dine them. That's what he's doing. And so Daniel is saying, essentially, by drawing the line, by saying, no, I'm not going to have your food or drink, he's saying, I'm not going to associate myself with you in an intimate way. I'm going to draw the line somewhere, at least where I can.
So what is give us some examples, if you'd be so kind, Austin, really from your own life, because I know where I do this in my own life. And for me, I have a platform. You have a platform down there at the church in Houston. But give me some examples of where you've kind of drawn that Daniel type line to say, OK, I'm drawing a line in the sand here and I'm not going to capitulate to what this dominant culture is trying to do.
Well, I think one of the ways that I've personally drawn a line is I don't react. And what I mean by draw the line, also Daniel drawing this line, this is about personal conviction, not about biblical ones. I think that's important because many of us will have personal convictions. And as soon as we make those biblical standards for other people to abide by as well, that's where we've gone too far.
So
we need to live with personal conviction where we believe, okay, this might be better, for example. So for example, I have many friends on my Twitter who follow me from college who are, they believe very differently than me. They are more left-wing. They are more agnostic. They are more atheistic. And they have certain perspectives of evangelicals that the media obviously feeds them. Maybe they've even had experience with in their own life. So one of the ways that I've drawn a line in the sand myself is I'm going to say, with all the things that are going wrong in our culture, it, you know, for me to, on Twitter, you know, speak in ways that are against, like, for example, the Breonna Taylor situation, for example, to speak out on that and give I've personally chosen to draw the line that I'm not going to speak on it because I'm not a jury. I'm not. And even if I do, I don't want it to be a stumbling block to my friends who, as soon as I bring up a different perspective, they're going to start accusing me. That's not helpful. So, you know, the whole idea also behind that, though, is that, well, silence is violence. You know, you hear that motto in our culture. No, it's not. So if I speak, you're going to condemn me. And if I don't speak, then you're going to condemn me. Well, you know, the line I've kind of chosen to draw, at least on Twitter, is, well, I'm just not going to engage. It's just not worth, nothing productive is going to come from it, at least from my friend group.
Yep.
So that's kind of one way I've drawn a line in the sand, if you will.
Yeah, we can do it. We can look at it in terms of political ramifications and voting and the things that you talk about. And again, I think that's a great point in terms of personal convictions. And it's contextual. So my main audience on this show and on Facebook are fellow conservative Christians above the age of 40. And so I kind of engage my people group knowing that we've got some blind spots. We've got to kind of replace some of our political focus with a gospel focus. And so I really focus on that crowd. But if my crowd were a bunch of younger people your age that weren't believers, were agnostic or atheistic, that would completely change what I talk about and how I talk about things.
Absolutely.
I think that's a great point. Got to read this article for yourself, everybody. AustinGentry.com. I put the links up on Facebook Live. I wish we had some more time, but we'll do it again, Austin. It's great to hear you.
I know.
And it's great to have you back on the show.
Likewise.
All right, man.
Thanks
we'll
so
talk again real
you.
Soon. You're welcome.
Thanks
we'll
so
do
much.
It again. You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye. AustinGentry.com. I put the links up there. So much to work through. Where are you going to draw the line in your life for the cause of Christ? It's a great question. This is Steve Noble on The Steve Noble Show. God willing, I'll talk to you again real soon. And like my dad always used to say, ever forward.
Another program powered by the Truth Network.